This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. On March 6th, 2020, the State Department of Health confirmed Indiana's first case of COVID-19. In the 2 years since, the pandemic has had an immeasurable impact on nearly every facet of life for people in the state. As we prepare to wrap up our show, which ends on April 1st, we wanted to spend some time reflecting on those 2 years with two people we've been talking to since the very beginning. We're joined by Shandy Dirth and Tom Dzinski, both from the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at Indiana University. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us. I just want to say from Tom and I both that we just want to say thank you to the entire WFYI crew for being such a solid source of truth and information during all of this. We would never have imagined how much misinformation could come out of this. And so you guys have all been a true public health partner. So I just want to thank you guys, and we're sad to see the show go.
I'd echo Shandy's statement there that we appreciate these opportunities to work with the media to get good, solid information out.
Thank you so much for coming on the program whenever we need you to come on, and always having great, insightful conversations.
Thank you.
Happy to help.
Shandy, let's get into this and start with, you know, you're a working health professional, and you've been working through this pandemic. You've done contact tracing, among other things. Has it been difficult to reflect on what's happened so far? Has there been too much information to just go sit back and get perspective, or have you had some time to kind of evaluate?
So I'm getting to that point where we are starting to wind down, and I am going back trying to write some summary reports and that sort of thing. And I got to say, it is amazing how much work we put into this, Tom's group as well, and how many different things we did over the last 2 years. Because we, in public health, we are very good at pivoting when we need to pivot. And we pivoted so many times during the last 2 years. And so I think we have a lot of lessons learned we'll be able to use in public health going forward. And I just hope that we can build up public health here in the state of Indiana so that we're better prepared for the next pandemic, because there will be another one. I don't know exactly when, but I guarantee, you know, we're not out of this one yet, but we need to be preparing for the next one as well.
Yeah, I've heard some folks saying this is just a practice run for the real pandemic coming in the future.
I think this is a big practice, yes.
Yeah, that's something that we should probably keep in mind. Tom, it's a massive world event that's gone on for a very, very long time now, this COVID-19 pandemic. What is it like to learn and adapt while something like this is still happening?
Yeah, that's, as Shandy was mentioned, this is what we do in public health. We, you know, when we get a novel strain of coronavirus or some other disease-causing agent, we're learning just as fast as we can, and we're putting out new information as we learn. And that sometimes can seem like a challenge to people, right? That, oh, we're changing our mind, or, you know, what we weren't saying before was accurate, but it was. And as the science changes, we have to change and adapt to that and ask people to do the same, right? So, again, this is kind of what public health does. And we're responded, I think, well to this, and really hope that a lot of people understand the changing science of it. And this is going to keep changing, right? I mean, as Shandy indicated, we are not done with this. This virus isn't done with us, and we're not done with it yet. So we're going to stay vigilant. We're going to stay on top of this and put out more information as we learn.
When you mention, you know, the science changes and we change and we adapt with it, I think sometimes it's harder for those of us who aren't in the day-to-day. It does sound like things keep changing and we don't know what to believe or what to trust, and it feels a little bit overwhelming. How would you advise folks who are keeping up, you know, every day at every little update, they're trying to make sure they know what's going on? Shandy, is it worth it to do that every day? Is it something you should look at maybe once a week?
So those of us who work in it have to do it every day. But if you don't have to work in this every day, I would advise for your own mental sanity to probably, you know, check in once a week or so for the updates. You know, in the beginning of this, it was constantly changing daily. And I do feel like those changes are happening less frequently now at this point, especially as we see mandates go away and the new CDC guidance come out. But I do encourage you to have conversations too with your provider about vaccines. Make sure you're up to date on your vaccinations, that sort of thing. A lot of people kind of miss the memo about, you know, needing that second J&J vaccine or needing the booster for the Moderna and Pfizer. So we still need to do work in those areas. So still stay in touch. but you definitely don't have to have your life revolve around it, as we've seen. Other people can go on. And I see Tom and I, you know, moving away from COVID eventually too, hopefully.
Tom, you were actually on our very first show about this, which aired on March 11th of 2020. And at that point, 10 people in Indiana had tested positive for COVID-19. During that episode, you'd said that different states in the country are typically good at communicating with each other during situations like this. Did that end up being true?
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of our public health partners around the country and really around the world are part of the sharing of information. And I think that's what allowed us to move so quickly and advance the science more quickly, is that everybody shared what they knew about this because we were all in the same boat, right? Unfortunately, some other countries were experiencing the worst of it before we were. So that actually helped us to understand and what to prepare for and be ready for. And then we shared that information of what we learned onto other countries, right? So it wasn't just here in the US, but this was a global effort because everybody in the world was affected by this.
You mentioned this is what you both do in public health, Shandy and Tom, and you know you follow these things that are happening and keep up with it and the changing science. Shandy, one thing that I'm curious about is I think early on there was a lot of criticism that the federal government wasn't prepared and had been warned for many years that they needed to be ready for a pandemic. Do you feel like you and other public health officials and were prepared for this, or do you think that there should have been more done?
So I think a small number of people were prepared, but unfortunately what we saw after 9/11, public health emergency preparedness really grew in this country. And every year that passed, the amount of funding and attention and effort into emergency preparedness dwindled more and more each year. And unfortunately, the way it's been set up in public health around the US is that a lot of health departments were using those emergency funds to plan for not just a possible anthrax attack, but pandemic flu, a new bird flu, things of that nature. And so as that money dwindled, the people who had been experts at that, they went away. Their expertise went away. A lot of health departments still had a lot of stuff that they bought after 9/11. So like trailers and equipment and things like that, refrigerated trailers for storage for vaccine, that sort of thing. But they didn't necessarily have the trained staff. And that's something that I hope really is more sustainable going forward. We do that too often in public health. You see a big outbreak of something, you put a lot of money into it, the numbers go down, you walk away from it. And we really need to make it more of a sustained effort for surveillance, for subject matter experts and everything going forward. Otherwise, we're just in this constant cycle of responding to fires rather than preventing them.
Right. So we're a lot more reactive right now than proactive, would you say?
Correct.
Tom, what do you think of the way Indiana as a state has communicated with the general public about this since it all began?
Well, I think Indiana, like a lot of states, we were in the same boat of not really understanding everything there is to know about this virus, and we still don't. I will say that Indiana, like other states, also tried to put out information, right, and stand up dashboards to give counts and positivity rates and things like that. So those are all wonderful efforts. But, you know, I think the thing that, and Shandy spoke very clearly about this, is that we simply aren't putting prevention first. And that's really where we need to be so that when these things do happen, and it'll happen again, we are better prepared to minimize disease in the state of Indiana and prevent hospitalizations and death from things like this from occurring. I mean, we can do this. We know how to do this. We've responded to multiple pandemics, both in the 20th century and now again in the 21st century. But you can't put funding after the fact. You have to put the funding before in order to be prepared and ready for when these things occur.
What would you say, Tom, would be like the ideal proactive approach aside from getting funding ahead of time?
Yeah, I think one of the obviously the funding piece, but having these persons in place that can do this, right? So in Indiana, we are one, underfunded, two, we are short-staffed to respond to things like this, right? We do the things that we are absolutely necessary to do every day, kind of at that minimum level, but when something else occurs, we don't have any capacity to go beyond that, right? So when something bad happens, we had just enough people to get by through the day-to-day operations, but we need more, right? And doing it after the fact is not a great way to do business.
Before we head to break, real quick, Shandy, do you look back at the way Indiana communicated on this public health emergency and see any things that could be improved, or do you think it was pretty good so far?
I was happy to see the press conferences with the Indiana Department of Health and the governor. I think that showed a good partnership between the two, and I think they really worked on transparency, which was good. Pretty early on, I think every state, not just Indiana, we need to get better about working with vulnerable populations and people who don't have English as their first language. From what I saw, a lot of states were slow at getting information out there in something other than English, honestly. And we need to just keep that in our planning pocket as we go forward to make sure that we're covering all the bases, that we're very inclusive in our planning going forward. So I hope we really improve on that in all aspects of public health, not just emergency preparedness in the future.
Have you seen some improvement over this 2-year period in the communication strategy?
I have. I have seen, you know, Google Translate, something as simple as Google Translate being added onto pages can really be a huge help. I've seen more effort towards putting resources out there through like 211. So people who don't use the internet can still call and talk to a real person. I mean, during our case investigations and contact tracing, especially early on when everything was locked down, some people really just wanted to talk to a person sometimes. They were just happy to talk to a live person. But also, people are in a panic mode, and so they want it to be able to ask questions and not just read from an internet page. So I think we need to, you know, even though it might be easier to put everything just on the web, we need to make sure that we're actually reaching people the way they need to be reached. We need to meet them where they are. And I think we have improved over that. Hopefully we'll keep improving.
Well, we'll be back after a quick break. We're spending the hour with two health experts to reflect on the last 2 years of the pandemic. If you have any questions or comments, you can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're reflecting on the last 2 years of the pandemic in Indiana with two health experts who've been talking us through it since it began. We're joined by Shandy Dearth and Tom Dzinski, both from the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at Indiana University. Shandy, before the break, we were talking a little bit about how Indiana has been communicating with the general public since the pandemic started. What about how all the different levels of government have communicated and worked together? Has there been a clear process for that, or maybe a process that's solidified over time?
Yes and no. I would say if you ask local health departments if communication has always been clear, you're going to hear some no's in that. I think it's definitely improved over time. And I know the state agencies are always working on improving that. And I would say that's true not just for Indiana, but for all states. I think there's constantly a need for improvement between communication between people on the ground doing the work at the local level and people at the state and federal level with the supplies, with the funding, that sort of thing. I do think that's improving. I know with the health departments and the state health department, they've had regular calls each week since the beginning, which has been, they've been really, really helpful. And then they have Q&A sessions on there. They've set up, you know, email inboxes specifically for certain parts of the COVID response, whether it be vaccine, testing, that sort of thing. So all of that's been really helpful. And at the same time, I just want to point out that the Indiana Department of Health has been just as understaffed as the local health departments in the state. So when I say we need to build up public health, we need to build up all aspects of public health. And so if we could keep the staffing levels strong, I think that communication would just naturally improve the next time around.
You know, we've talked a lot about staffing levels for nurses, for example, and other folks in healthcare. Would you say that public health is facing a similar situation where people are retiring and leaving the field and not enough are coming back in?
It's a definite crisis. So not only are they retiring, some people retired because they were going to retire before COVID. They stuck it out to get everyone through COVID. And they're just done, or honestly, COVID burned them out to the point where they're taking early retirements. Or I'm seeing a lot of mass exodus right now in local health departments because staff have been burned out. They've been attacked. I mean, we've had really good public health leaders in the state just leave their positions because they've just been abused by the public too often, unfortunately. And I would have never expected to see that during all of this. And so we've got a definite staffing crisis in the state, but also, again, across the U.S. Indiana is not unique in this. Epidemiologists, you know, the field that Tom and I, you know, live in every day, there's a huge need for epidemiology right now. So in addition to staffing, we need to train those people. We need more programs in schools of public health to train more people, more faculty to train those people, because we have seen that mass exodus and we need to fill that gap quickly. Because otherwise, as we've seen, we pay the price when we're too understaffed in those areas.
Right. I was thinking with the spotlight sort of lit up on public health and people understanding more about this field and as a career path. Tom, do you think there's been more interest in public health careers? Have you seen folks express that they want to get involved, or are they scared because of the burnout?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, we have seen an increase in our School of Public Health, right? The enrollment actually went up in our School of Public Health, people seeking more education around public health and epidemiology and social behavioral sciences. We see that increase because other schools on our campus, their enrollment actually went down during the pandemic. And some of this has to do with the fear of being out in public and in the large classrooms with a lot of people and stuff. But there's been a spotlight on public health, good or bad, however you want to look at it, and interest in the sciences itself. Shandy brought up this point about epidemiologists. The Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists, which is across the country, they do a survey of need about every 5 years. And prior to the pandemic, we needed a 36% increase in the number of epidemiologists in this country just to get to where we should be. So we were already in a deficit to begin with. And the pandemic, as Shandy indicated, has made it a little bit worse. So I'm hoping, given the education we've been putting out, working with you on this radio program, for example, telling people what epidemiology is and what public health is and what we do, will actually bring more people to the science and hopefully get us back up to capacity.
Well, educating the public about this field is one thing. There's also the idea that there's been some misinformation as an issue during this pandemic, whether it's misinformation about the work that you do or just misinformation around the pandemic. Do any specific things stick out to you as particularly harmful, Tom, that you've seen in the last 2 years?
I think the biggest thing that concerned me was not doing the basic protective measures, right? Vaccines are wonderful. I've been saying the mRNA, the M stands for a miracle because it's really has been tremendous. But prior to vaccines and treatments, those basic public health messages about, you know, keeping a mask on, physical distancing, good hand hygiene, were just simply being ignored by so many people. They were very cavalier and like the virus isn't going to hurt me and things like that. And unfortunately, the numbers tell a different story. Whether it's cases, hospitalizations, or deaths. And we've seen a lot of people, unfortunately, in Indiana and across the U.S., maybe at a higher rate than some other countries, die unnecessarily from this disease.
Shandy, are there any things you think that have caused the most information to spread?
So there's actually been a lot of research in that area, and you can pinpoint some specific lies, basically, pointing to like internet sources. And so we've all been battling the issue of whether or not the vaccine can affect fertility. And basically it was a guy in Australia made that go viral. And so the internet can be great for sharing, you know, up-to-date information and truth. But unfortunately, we've seen it go the other way during COVID. And there are researchers out there right now trying to pinpoint exactly how those spiraled out of control. And as you've probably seen, the Surgeon General is really attacking misinformation. And he's going at the corporate offices at this point, too, to say, you need to share some information with us because we have to figure out how to fix this for next time. And as we talk about vaccines, it's horrendous that we don't have higher vaccination rates. The deaths we're seeing right now, you know, most of them really could have been prevented with vaccines, but then some of that is going to spill over to our other vaccines that we've had available and in use for decades. And my fear is that, you know, the next outbreak is going to be measles or mumps or polio. That's not been eradicated yet. We saw that in other countries. And so we really need to get ahead of this misinformation cycle that we somehow hopped on in the last few years and get control of that again.
Yeah, I think, you know, if I don't mind interject here, Shandy, you're right, this misinformation. So I'm glad to see some of these social media platforms actually taking a proactive stance against misinformation, and people posting misinformation actually gets checked and removed in some instances. So to me, that's a really good thing. Others see it as an infringement on their freedom of speech. But we remember these are private companies and they can kind of control the narrative if they want.
Well, and I like to point out, too, I can't walk into a crowded theater and yell fire if it's not true.
Correct.
So at this point, COVID is, you know, a raging forest fire taking out millions of people across the globe. And so at this point, I think it should be illegal to knowingly spread misinformation at this point.
Yeah, it's definitely unfortunate just how rapidly misinformation spreads. And I think we've done shows on this in the past where for some reason, negative information spreads quicker. And people are more likely to engage with that stuff. Tom, what are some of the primary ways you think health officials and governments have tried to combat misinformation aside from maybe trying to go after these companies?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's been putting consistent faces around some of this information. So as Shandy mentioned, the Surgeon General, right? You want somebody kind of be the face of the pandemic here in the U.S., whether that's Dr. Fauci or the Surgeon General or whomever, right? We want people of reputation and science and can speak to people and kind of where what Shandy indicated, meet them where they're at with good, solid information, right? And be consistent around that. I think those are important strategies that we've seen the government start doing, right? That we have these sort of consistent partners that we look to. And that's what I would encourage a lot of your listeners to do as well, is find that consistent, reputable source of information, like your primary care provider, your state or local health department, all wonderful people working really hard, understanding the science and trying to communicate to individuals to improve or, you know, improve their health or even prevent disease.
Shandy, there's the misinformation, there's conspiracy theories that have had an impact on vaccine rates and social behavior, I think. Have you seen that here in Indiana, that these things have convinced folks, for example, to not get vaccinated?
Oh, definitely. We've seen that. I would say probably every bit of misinformation that's anywhere in the world has at some point entered into Indiana. So we've had to battle that here. And it's evident, obviously, with some of our lower vaccination rates, especially in some of the rural areas. And so that's unfortunate. I'm really discouraged by, again, the fertility issue, the fact that people don't understand that the vaccines are safe, that we're not just putting them out there for profit or something like that. I mean, it's a lot of work to get the vaccines out. No one's going to spend that amount of time or effort. That's not a good vaccine. It's not something we need to do. So again, we need to, you know, gain the trust of the public and get them to understand who we are and what we do. And, you know, public health before COVID, we all talked about how no one knew what public health was. And now that people know us because of COVID, so many people are mad at us because of what we tell you can't do. I think we need to go back to the basics and teach people again, you know, public health is what helps keep your water safe to drink. It's what keeps, you know, the streams clean so you can go fishing on the weekends with your kids. You know, we do all of those little steps along the way that you don't think about and that you take for granted. And you can't take for granted because you don't have, you know, if you're not in the field, you're not doing the work. And so I think we need to build that trust with the community past COVID. Otherwise, I think this misinformation will just keep spreading.
I think we might need to have some kind of a reality show where we follow you and Tom around and see what you do.
That could be good and bad, but yes, I'm sure we've talked about that. Actually, to do a communication campaign around Indiana, we're working on that actually with IU right now and some of the local health officers around the state, and we are really going to start doing some of that work in the coming months so people understand what public health is and so there's a greater appreciation. Unfortunately, what we've seen in the Indiana legislation in the last year is a lot of public health authority has been removed, and that's really detrimental to the health and financial safety, honestly, of the state. Things like the septic bill that was going through, you know, last week, that can have some pretty grave consequences for homeowners. And so we definitely need to get the word out there to the general public.
When you look back, Tom, at the last 2 years, did you ever envision that working in public health would be considered almost a dangerous job?
No, to be honest. And, you know, since being interviewed so many times, not only with your program, but with other media outlets and such. I mean, I know Shandy and I both received, you know, some odd phone calls and just, you know, things that didn't seem quite right that we've obviously reported. But I never really thought that we would be the source of an attack, basically, against public health. I mean, Shandy brought up, you know, these ideas behind septic systems and clean water, but even the clean food that we take for granted every day, right? These are all public health things. And we don't necessarily do these jobs for credit and say, oh, look what we did for everybody, right? We're really invested in the public's health. And we recognize the healthy community is a happy community. It's a prosperous community, right? And we're not going to advance as a society until we improve our health across the board. So that's what I get great pleasure out of working in public health in, and I'm sure others have as well. But yeah, it's been a real eye-opener for us to see some of these public health people that, you know, both Shandy and I look up to just walk away from the position because of the threats and stuff.
Shandy, what are your feelings about this in the last 2 years, just seeing sort of the discussion and commentary around this field?
So I agree with Tom. I would have never expected the attacks. I mean, I understand sometimes we aren't the welcomed people. You know, I used to be a restaurant inspector eons ago when I was first out of college, so I wasn't always the person restaurant owner might want to see. But, you know, a good restaurant owner also understood that we would help protect them from causing an outbreak that would kill their business. And I think that respect has been lost out there in the community, unfortunately. I have been saddened to see the attacks on the leaders in public health. As Tom mentioned, he and I have had weird phone calls, some, you know, sometimes hateful emails, that sort of thing. But I've never felt, you know, where I was unsafe. It was never that bad where I was worried about myself or my family. I can say I've had several conversations with public health people around the state and here in Indiana who received death threats. I had a health officer tell me not that long ago that he still does not stand in his living room in the middle of the night with his curtains open. Wow. I had another health officer say that he kept track of all of the threats against him, and he showed his wife where it was locked up, and she was to give that to the police if something should happen to him. So these threats have been severe. It's caused a lot of people to leave, and we really need, you know, we need to get people to back off of that. We need these public health officials. As Tom said, people don't enter public health for like the glamour. I think my first day on the job in public health, I was pouring dye down a toilet to do a dye test at a house. And also, I mean, a lot of people go into this field. They've got a lot of school loans. They're not making a lot of money, but they're really dedicated to improving their community. So they're not out there to take anyone's rights away or to tell someone not to do something. They really are trying to make a better community for their family members and for their friends.
Yeah, it's a shame that there's a misunderstanding and misinformation around a field that you think it has nothing to do with politics. It's just a general field trying to make us safer and healthier.
Right. We tried to just follow the science, honestly, and ignore the politics. But unfortunately, sometimes the politics really, you know, affect what we can and cannot do.
Before we head to break, Tom, are there any things that you learned about the virus that we didn't understand at the beginning that you know now? And we can pick up on this when we get back from break as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've learned so much about this virus and the people it affects and how it affects them. And honestly, we're going to keep learning more about this particular virus probably for the next decade.
Is there anything specific that you saw that changed your mind about the virus from when you first learned about it?
I think the biggest thing is, you know, especially when we looked at things like Delta and Omicron, is how it transitioned to be more infectious, right? So it took less viral particles to actually infect people. And this is a piece of evolution that we see with viruses and pandemics, essentially, that in order to kind of survive, they have to adapt to their environment, just like we do, right? But they're very efficient at it. And it's been kind of surprising to me just how fast and efficient this virus became.
Well, we'll be back after a quick break. We're talking with two health experts to reflect on the last 2 years of the COVID-19 pandemic. If you have questions or comments, you can always find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. It's been almost exactly 2 years since the pandemic hit Indiana, and we're spending the hour today reflecting on what's happened with two health experts who've been with us since the start. We're joined by Shandy Durth and Tom Dzinski, both from the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at Indiana University. Before the break, we kind of touched upon some of the things that you've seen about the virus that maybe you didn't see in the beginning and now you're seeing. Shandy, we've seen a number of variants since the pandemic began. What is the latest on Omicron? Although I think Omicron is now not even one of the latest. I think there's been a couple of variants since then.
Well, right now we're seeing the subvariant of Omicron spread. It looks, you know, somewhat more contagious, but not more deadly, which is good. There's constant surveillance going on around the world for any new variants of concern that might pop up. Right now, Omicron is really the variant of concern that we're looking at. Again, we've got vaccination rates, hitting 70% in many parts of the U.S., but I do want to remind everyone, in some countries, we've got vaccination rates as low as 14%. So if we've got all of those people not immunized and they haven't had COVID yet, they're not going to have that immunity. So that means we have that many more susceptible people who can get COVID. We could see new variants arise, that sort of thing. So that's why we've got to keep our guard up with surveillance and other things going forward so that we're not surprised by a new variant.
Tom, what have we seen with the vaccines and boosters since those started going out to people? Are we seeing the efficacy is doing well? Are we learning anything new around that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the vaccines themselves, especially Pfizer and Moderna's mRNA vaccine, have proved to be very efficient at preventing hospitalizations and death from this virus and its variants, right? That was a really important thing. The other thing that we learned is that the vaccine, like natural infection even, it doesn't last forever, right? We don't have that kind of continual immunity for a lifetime from getting vaccinated. And we see that with other vaccines as well, right? So that's not anything new to us. But what we did see is that the vaccinations and then getting boosted actually proved to be a better protection against Omicron than having a previous infection. So that there's evidence to say that, look, having a previous infection, you still get some immunity, but it doesn't last as long as when you get vaccinated. And some have even equated to having previous infection as getting a single dose of the vaccine, which really we knew wasn't efficient at protecting us. So that's why we got two doses of the mRNA vaccines and then 5 months later get boosted. Those have been just amazing, like I said, vaccines for protecting us and have kept a lot of people out of the hospital and dying.
Yeah, I remember when Omicron was first coming out and everybody was warning about it. Some people in my household ended up getting sick, but they were fully vaccinated and boosted. And it was still pretty scary. And I was thinking, like, if they weren't vaccinated, I don't even know what would have happened.
Absolutely. Right. And that's a thing that I think people misunderstand about vaccines. The vaccine isn't going to keep you from necessarily getting infected, right? This is still a virus. You still could breathe it in and gets in your lungs. What the vaccine does is prevent that kind of rapid replication of the virus in your system, which will cause severe illness, put you in the hospital, and some unfortunately die from that. So the vaccines were very good at keeping people out of the hospital and dying from that, even though they still had what we call a breakthrough infection.
Right, right. And witnessing that firsthand, I think it also just opens your eyes to just how serious this can be. Shandy, when it comes to where Indiana stands and the stage that we're at in this pandemic, how would you characterize it?
So we've definitely improved over the last few weeks. December and January were very, very rough. We saw, you know, record case counts each day. Hospitalizations were through the roof. but we've greatly improved starting towards the end of January, all through February, and we're continuing that trend. So right now, if you're someone still looking at the positivity rates, the state of Indiana is at 3.7% positivity. Marion County, where Indianapolis is at 2.9. The CDC has transitioned to that new mapping system where they're looking at transmission levels, a low, medium, high. And much of Indiana is at the low, which is great, which is why you're seeing the masks come off at this point.
The masks coming off, the loosened restrictions, is that concern at all that we're just going to see another increase in the near future, Tom?
So that's something that Shani mentioned we're always doing surveillance for, right? We're looking for that. Certainly, you know, keeping those vaccination rates high will help prevent some of that. But every time somebody gets infected, there's an opportunity for a mutation to occur and, you know, maybe a new variant to emerge in the population. So while easing some of these restrictions is a nice thing to have, and it's based on the science right now that we know, right, this low positivity, low transmission, we have to remember that we're still not over this pandemic and that if we get a new variant, then we may need another booster. We may need to put masks back on. We may need to do physical distancing again, right? And that's just part of the science and understanding this. So again, we're not over this. I mean, more than likely what will happen is this is going to become an endemic disease, kind of like influenza, where we're going to see annual infections and maybe need a booster every year.
Shandy, with the relaxed measures, I think some of us may have a false sense of security and think, well, we don't need to test anymore. We don't need to wear masks. What do you think?
So I would say, think about your surroundings, where you're going. You know, if you're going to travel over spring break, look at that CDC map across the U.S. There's still some hot spots around the country. So right now, Kentucky, West Virginia, and Virginia are still in the high category. So if I were going to go there during spring break, I would definitely keep up the mask use, keep some social distancing in place, avoid crowds, large crowds indoors. You don't know the vaccination status of all of these people. And I would encourage everyone to go ahead and test before and after spring break if you are traveling. So even though we're low here in Indiana, if you travel somewhere else, you might be going through airports where you've got lots of people from all over the world. You just don't know the mix of vaccination status, that sort of thing, when you're in those kinds of settings. So just be aware. We've learned a lot in the last 2 years. Don't forget what you learned over the last 2 years. And I encourage everyone to keep, you know, those masks on hand, not just when you're traveling, but in the fall, I really expect we'll see another bump, you know, as kids go back into school again, it gets cold again. As Tom said, we imagine this will probably become a regular annual thing that we see, but we know how to deal with it now. We know the mask use works, vaccines work. So we need to keep those tools and not throw them away. You know, just because I feel like I'm a pretty good driver, regardless of what my husband says, I still wear my seatbelt. So, you know, keep your seatbelt on going forward.
Tom, do you think this removal of some of these measures is unfair for some folks who, you know, maybe they're high risk or there's children who can't get vaccinated yet? And it almost seems like we're kind of forgetting that they're still out there.
Yeah, that's a really important point because, and that's what I've been telling people is, look, I understand nobody likes wearing a mask, right? And they can be uncomfortable, especially as we get into warmer months and things like that. But it's always been about, and this usually how public health works, it's about helping other people, right? And being cognizant of other people's situation. It isn't necessarily just about you, right? That I wear a mask a lot, you know, simply because I know there are people out there that are immunocompromised or have other conditions that will put them at higher risk. I was just looking at the numbers. And looking across the state of Indiana, since the pandemic began, 1.6 million cases just in Indiana alone, 22,000 deaths in Indiana alone. So it doesn't just affect those 22,000 people that died, right? Think about all the family members that have lost loved ones because of that. So we can do more as a society. We can protect others with a little inconvenience and a little bit more forethought. Around that.
Shandy, when you look back at all the stuff that we've been going through, and I know we kind of touched upon this earlier, but do you think that we're more prepared now if we go into a different kind of a pandemic, one that may be worse than this one?
I think we are. As Tom mentioned, things like dashboards, that was something that was not super common before COVID. We had it for some diseases, some surveillance projects. But I think something as simple as putting out public-facing dashboards for people to see the data themselves, I think, will help. You know, we weren't just doing practices during COVID. Mm-hmm. We've set up mass vaccination and testing clinics. So everyone has experience in that now. So I think, you know, as long as we can keep some of the staffing around, I think we're definitely better prepared for next time. But again, it's losing some of that historical knowledge I'm fearful of as people retire or leave public health. So I think we need to make sure that we build in that infrastructure, that just because the person leaves doesn't mean the knowledge leaves, and we can keep that training in place going forward.
And Tom, has this pandemic changed the way you think about epidemiology and the work you do?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just the science behind understanding how this virus is transmitted. Like I said, we're going to be studying this for the next decade. And it's going to hopefully prepare us for the next one, right? Whatever's coming next and whenever it comes next. So I think that we've learned a lot about this. We're learning how to do preparedness. We have these conversations in the classroom now, what works, what doesn't work. I'm working with some students as we speak about how did messaging work among college students, right? Where did they get their messages from? How were they perceived, right? What were some reliable sources of information that they went to? So helping me understand that in the classroom, we could then use that in public health practice. This idea of, look, you want to communicate with college students, network news may not be the best place. You know, everybody tune in at 11 p.m. at night, that we might need some more social media type apps that push information out. Right. So there's a lot to learn from this pandemic, more than just about the virus itself.
Right. And then when I think about social media, I think also like verified sources or social media literacy for folks, because I mean, the other day I had my daughter's teacher share something and it was from someone's Instagram page. They made like an infographic and I'm like, they're not an expert. Why would you share a random infographic?
Right.
But it seems like, you know, it's kind of hard sometimes to navigate.
It is. It's really hard. And, you know, who, just because you look like a reliable source doesn't mean you necessarily are, right? So that's another important piece. And just, again, understanding how we can best communicate and meet people where they're at with reliable health information and help raise the health literacy of the population itself.
Shandy, what lessons do you hope we've learned from all of this?
So as Tom said, I think communicating with the public, we've learned a lot there and we have a lot more to learn. And I think that was kind of a sticking point with CDC is that, you know, the people at CDC wanted to share all the information. As an epidemiologist, I also want to share all the data. But at the same time, when you're sharing that with the general public, it's too easy to overwhelm people. And I think we need to go back to those, speech 101 basics. When you're giving a presentation, what are the three main points you want to get across? And I always think about the H1N1 response in 2009. I was working in public health, and the head of CDC at that time said, I will always tell people what we know, what we don't know, and what we're doing to figure out what's happening, you know, what they're doing to figure out that answer. And I think we need to get back to the basics on this somehow. You know, COVID was very overwhelming for all of us. Information was coming out so fast and we wanted to share it, but we needed to learn how to share it in a digestible manner for the general public, because not everyone lives in the world of statistics all the time like we do.
Yeah. And I think when we were in lockdown and there was nothing else to do but like check updates every 5 minutes on the news, we all thought we were experts by the end of lockdown.
Yes. And, you know, I was happy to see some armchair experts join the group and get excited about numbers. You know, like I can geek out about numbers and fun with numbers and that sort of thing. But unfortunately, we can see it go the wrong way as misinformation spreads.
When it comes to this pandemic sort of at a lull right now, Tom, are you worried at all about people feeling like it's over, it's done?
Yeah, I do worry about that, but we've seen this throughout the pandemic. As cases go down, testing goes down, masks start coming off more, and then we see another spike or an increase in cases, and we start all over again. So that's always going to be a concern. I think the good news, though, is having things like the vaccine in place already will help reduce some of those surges. But it's going to be this constant effort that we're going to continue, like I said, probably for the next several years to get people to kind of in this routine of, hey, you might need a booster. If you're not feeling well, stay home, wear a mask, those kinds of things.
Shandy, we have about 2 minutes left. I'm curious to see what your thoughts are about what we're looking at as we move forward. Do you think that things are looking positive?
I think so. We're seeing more treatments come out, that sort of thing. I think we can do more education around vaccination. I can't say I am worried about the recent studies coming out showing possible changes in the brain and heart issues for those long haulers with COVID. And so the VA just did a big study looking at the increase in heart attacks and stroke among people who had COVID. So I think, you know, we'll be looking at this, as Tom said, for the next decade, but also probably decades. We're going to have to follow people, kind of like what they did with the Framingham Heart Study years ago. So we're going to have to see, you know, what's really the long-term effects. What's the long-term effects on the kids who had it and never really had a symptom? 5-10 years from now, we might start to see things. We just don't know. So we're going to have to keep an eye on it and not assume that it's over and that it's just going to become something like the flu, even though the surveillance might be the same. I'm afraid this will create more chronic conditions than we're aware of right now. We're just ready to, you know, take a breather. We're all kind of burned out. But I am happy to see the numbers go down in many parts of the U.S. right now at this point.
Before we wrap up, is there anything being looked at in public health in terms of messaging fatigue and how to keep that in mind for future, just that whole overwhelming load?
Yes, I can say there's a lot of research from both universities and public health associations working on how best to communicate. And they're doing focus groups with, you know, people all over the country as well and other countries trying to look into that.
Well, I want to thank you both for taking the time today and all the other days you joined us. It's really been a pleasure. Shandy Durth is director of the Center for Public Health Practice at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at Indiana University. And Tom Dusinski is director of epidemiology education, Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at Indiana University. Our producers are Drew Doblin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam So. Thanks for listening. This is All In.